Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the pending announcement of Ashton Carter as the new Secretary of Defence to replace Chuck Hagel, and speak with Pierre Spray, a veteran high-tech defence weapons and systems designer who was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 and the A-10. We will discuss the background of Ashton Carter as a champion of nuclear weapons and the latest efforts by the Air Force to kill the A-10 over the objections of the Congress, who are responding to pressure from the troops whose lives have been saved by this long-serving airplane the military-industrial complex wants to kill. Then we'll look into the bizarre cyber attacks on Sony Pictures by the North Koreans because of a forthcoming movie, The Interpreter, Sony is set to release that makes fun of North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, who apparently is not amused. Soo-mi Terry, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer of East Asia at the National Intelligence Council and the Director of Japan, Korea and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the reasons behind North Korea's fury at the movie starring Seth Rogen and James Franco that has been banned in South Korea in deference to the North's sensitivity over the film. Then finally, we will speak with Mike Farrell, a political and social activist who starred in the TV series MASH and Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus and joins us to discuss the execution of a mentally ill man in Texas scheduled for 6 p.m. local time on Wednesday that so far Governor Rick Perry has refused to stay in spite of the urging from a group of prominent conservatives who have implored the governor that, quoting, it would be immoral for the government to take this man's life. Joining us now is Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. Welcome to Background Briefing, Pierre Spray.
Good to talk to you tonight.
And Pierre, it looks as though Obama is going to nominate Ashton Carter as the new Secretary of Defense to replace Chuck Hagel. The word is that that Ashton Carter is a wonk. There's also a lot of people think that Obama is a wonk as well. So is this a wonk choosing a wonk?
I hardly think that Obama is a wonk. And Ashton Carter is, I should say, an ambitious climber, not a wonk. I mean, he's served from time to time throughout his career as a wonk, and he has good credentials with that, but he's got plenty of business credentials, and he's kind of the answer to the maiden's prayer for Obama's problem on who to get for SecDef now that two of the best political candidates have turned him down.
And who's turned him down?
Michelle Flournoy, mm-hmm. who was, you know, far more of a wonk than Ashton Carter, but a very politically adept wonk, to say the least, and adept enough to realize this is a bad time to be SecDef. So she turned him down. She probably wants to be SecDef under Hillary Clinton, right, which will give her much more scope for fomenting permanent war.
Now, but who's the other choice that bailed on it?
The other one besides Michelle Flournoy was Jack Reed, who's a savvy enough politician to know better. Also, this is a bad time to serve, and a president and a White House that's very, very bad to serve under is SecDef, because you become kind of a messenger boy for all the internal politics of the White House.
Well, you hear constantly that the White House national security team is dysfunctional, that Susan Rice is a lightweight, that Obama is surrounded by lightweights. Is that what you're saying?
No, not at all. I'm saying they have a very specific agenda, and they intend to carry it out. I don't accuse them of being lightweights at all. I'm, you know, deeply opposed to their agenda, because their agenda is, you know, unending expansion of the American empire and keeping tensions high enough in all corners of the globe to make sure that the defense budget, you know, keeps on rising and to try to get out from under sequester. That's not my definition of lightweights, and they're not dysfunctional. I think they have a clear image of what they do. It happens to be really, really bad for the country, but that's a different question.
Well, then who's driving this? Because, you know, most people probably think that President Obama is a liberal and he's not a hawk.
That's a joke.
So,
that's a very sick joke to think that he's a liberal.
So explain further. You think is he driving this permanent war economy?
If he's not driving it, he's certainly he's certainly very much in agreement with it. I don't have enough insight into the inside of the White House to know who's driving who, but you know, there's certainly no dissension between him and his staff on the fact that he wants to continue the long quest to revive the Cold War that started under Clinton. He's very much in agreement with that, and he's working hard to do it and being quite effective at it. I don't call that dysfunctional at all. And in so doing, he's very much representing the interests of the establishment that paid for him to become president, you know, particularly the defense establishment, but it goes well beyond that. It's the whole, how shall I say, middle-of-the-road establishment that likes a state of permanent tension in the world and that, you know, very much supports American exceptionalism and the idea that we are, you know, the one superpower, the essential superpower, all that stuff. He's right smack in the middle of that camp. That's, you know, that to call that liberal is, like I say, a sick joke.
Again, I'm speaking with Pierre Spray, who's a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. And he left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. So then, following what you're saying, Pierre Spray, did Chuck Hagel try to do his job as he said he would try to do, you know, to cut back on the defense spending? Was he a casualty because he doesn't go along with this permanent war economy?
I didn't see much sign that he didn't go along with it.
What was his problem?
He was just a weak reed. He was very much in awe of the generals. They were able to bulldoze him on almost every issue. He represented them on almost every issue. And he may have voiced a faint dissent on Syria, perhaps. I'm not so sure of that, and I don't have, you know, his conversations to prove or disprove it. But, I mean, the overall fact is he was totally incapable of doing the job. And as my friend Winslow Wheeler said, his basic mistake was accepting the job, not anything he did afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So what's happening with the airplane that you designed, the A-10 ground attack jet? I understand that the Air Force is trying to sabotage its return or its extension. Is that what's happening?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The Air Force, for both money reasons and for more, you know, for kind of, how should I say, cultural reasons, the Air Force, ever since well before World War II, has hated close support, which is the mission that involves supporting the troops on the ground and, you know, helping them out when they're in trouble. The Air Force hates that. They hate being a servant to the Army. And that's for both bureaucratic reasons, because Air Force generals want to pick their own targets. They don't want Army generals to pick them for them. And much more importantly, because for budget reasons, because the way to get big budgets, and this has been true since the 1930s, is to build big bombers, you know, and in general, you know, lots of bombing-type equipment and airplanes. And they've always wanted to poo-poo close support because it requires small, you know, not very expensive airplanes. So it's not a road to big budgets. Close support has been, you know, the odd man out in supposedly essential Air Force missions. And the A-10 from the start, when we started it, there wasn't a day that some Air Force general wasn't trying to kill it, even before we'd flown it, you know, because they all hated the mission. It was a very peculiar set of circumstances, quite unique to the time, that allowed us to get away with it. I won't go into it.
Right.
But the Air Force is, we're talking now ancient history. I mean, really ancient history. They were trying to kill the A-10 by 1970, if not earlier.
Right.
You know, we started designing in around 68, 69, and they haven't stopped. And now they're using two things. One, the excuse of the sequester, saying that, oh, God, they're so tight for money. Can you imagine this? The Air Force is awash in money, even under sequester. But they're so tight for money, they can't even pay for the mechanics and the spare parts and the bullets for the A-10. And, of course, the other reason is they are pretty hard-pressed now to pay for the huge overruns on the F-35. And, in fact, after they got beaten back for heavy losses in all four military committees of the Congress, all four of them turned them down on their proposal to kill the A-10. They came back and said, well, actually, you know, it's not just about money we need, but it's also we need the maintenance people that the A-10 has because we were counting on them to bail out the schedule of the F-35. The F-35 is designed to have a totally phony first squadron operating capability at the end of 2016. This is totally fraudulent because it won't be able to operate at all. It won't be able to go to any war at that time. It won't even have the weapons to go to war. But they use that excuse of this schedule to say, well, if you don't give us a dead A-10, wipe out the A-10 and give us all those maintenance people from the A-10, we'll miss our deadline on this phony date. Hmm. And that was concocted on the spot. That's a new excuse invented this year. They've had 10 years to think about. I mean, much more than 10 years, actually. They've had since 2001 to think about where they're going to get the maintenance people for the F-35. Suddenly this year, they're desperate for maintenance people, and the Congress will jeopardize the schedule if they don't help the Air Force kill the A-10.
Well, P.S. Bray,
I mean, this is a desperate and vicious, you know, small example of how, you know, high-ranking officers, four-star generals, simply don't give a damn about the troops. They only care about the money. And Ashton Carter is certainly their man to help them do that.
But my understanding is that the reason why the Congress is standing up to the military-industrial complex and the revolving door of generals and the Air Force is, for the reasons that you explained, how they've hated this plane from the beginning, the fact of the matter is, isn't the reason that the A-10, that they want to extend it, is it's the most popular airplane with the troops, that it's been the most useful platform in all of the wars that the U.S. has had since the end of the Cold War, in particular in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are just plain facts, aren't they?
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. And the Congress, who normally is hardly in the business of opposing the Air Force's money desires, is responding here to a tremendous, you know, basically a groundswell from guys whose lives were saved by the A-10, from the forward controllers who brought it in and saw how much better it was than, you know, all the fast-moving, thin-skinned jets and bombers that the Air Force wants to use instead, and, of course, from A-10 pilots themselves. So, and there's a number of congressmen involved who also have A-10s in their district. This is not, you know, some hugely patriotic, self-denying surge of honesty on the part of the Congress.
Well, it never is.
Of course not. Although I will say that the leader in the Senate, in fact, kind of the pivot point of the whole assault on the Air Force position in the Congress is Senator Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire, who has no A-10s in her district and is simply doing this because she understands the mission, the importance of the mission, which, you know, among other things, she's learned from her husband, who's an A-10 pilot. So this, for her, this is a pretty selfless campaign, and she's done an admirably good job, and she's gathered some real senatorial heavyweights to back her. But she is, you know, she's the center of the alliance that's actually trying to, and I think will successfully stop the Air Force. We'll see. The chairman, the two committee chairmen who are in a key position right now are the House Armed Services Committee and the Buck McEwen and Senator Levin, who's the head of the Senate Armed Services.
Well, Levin is at the moment, but he's retiring. McCain's coming in.
No, he's he's head of the not the we're talking about the
The appropriations, are you?
Yeah. You're talking about appropriations. We're talking about the Senate Armed Services Committee. Anyhow, the two chairmen have just gotten together and put together some very snaky language that certainly allows the Air Force to get away with at least half of what they want to. And this is in defiance of all four committees that said no cutting of the 810 in fiscal 15. And the chairmen are defying those committees to make a compromise bill between the House and the Senate that they're now going to put out very shortly, and I guess eventually it'll get to a vote. I mean, there'll be a lot of hassling about it. There may well be a brutal floor fight over it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure Senator Ayotte and a few people in the House will lead a floor fight to kind of overturn these two chairmen that are, you know, that are simply representing the Air Force and the military-industrial complex to help kill the A-10. It'll be very interesting, though. There's some tense moments ahead.
Well, but what will be interesting for me in this upcoming battle, a part of a long battle, you say it goes back to 1970, and that is the position of the new Secretary of Defense, Ashton Carter.
He will most certainly back the Air Force. He is complete representative, complete and quite able representative of the military-industrial complex. He's a guy who trained as a nuclear scientist and immediately became a political scientist. He hardly put in a year or two doing any science, and from there it's all been first nuclear politics and then international politics and a classic of the revolving door, revolving in and out of the Pentagon and in and out of all their most important boards. In the early 90s, he helped to participate in the Bill Clinton firing up of the Cold War. He was very instrumental. He was an assistant secretary of defense for international security policy, and that was a great position from which to start fomenting all the troubles that we're having in Eastern Europe. He was very much a part of that. And he's rotated back and forth, including with some very high rollers in the defense financial area. He became a protege of Bill Perry, who was very much a major defense money man for the Democrats after he was Secretary of Defense, and who, by the way, had a very similar career of going from, you know, sophisticated scientific engineering background and immediately becoming a defense politician of one sort or another.
Well, we know that the word is now they're starting to lay the groundwork for having a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, as if they, you know,
absolutely.
It's unbelievable that they're trying to pull that one off. And
Ashton Carter is at the very heart of that nuclear cartel. He has been most of his career. He's a real nuclear nut himself.
Well, let's just get to the final big question here, Pierre Spray, and that is the president himself. The president and the first lady go out of their way to say how much they care about the troops. If the troops, and it's true, from my understanding, if the troops, their favorite weapon is the A-10, it saved their lives, it's the most effective weapon in the current wars that the U.S. has gotten itself into. So is he going to come out against it too?
He will support the Air Force. He will support Ashton Carter. He has to the hilt so far. Hagel supported the Air Force. That was approved by the White House. He hasn't made any speeches about the A-10. He's far too smart to, but he's certainly not stopping them from killing the A-10. And so you can only assume it's completely with his approval and it will continue. Unless the Congress, at this point, it's only the Congress that can stop this. There's not a chance that the White House will stop this.
Well, Pierre Spray, I thank you for joining us here today.
Okay. Enjoyed the talk. You're talking about something that's very near and dear to my heart.
I got that impression, yes. All right, Pierre. It's good to talk to you.
Hey, great talking to you always.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Pierre Spray, who is a veteran high-tech defense weapons and systems designer, as well as a highly regarded producer of avant-garde jazz and other genre recordings. Pierre Spray was the primary designer of two key Air Force warplanes, the F-16 fighter and the A-10 ground attack jet. He left the Pentagon in 1986 and went on to found Maple Shade Records. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the bizarre cyber attacks on Sony Pictures by the North Koreans. Absolutely. Now get sad again. Whoa. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sumi Terry.
Thank you for having me back.
And so the North Korean authorities have refused to deny any involvement in the cyber attack on Sony Pictures, where a number of movies, some of which haven't been released yet, have been handed over to pirating sites, which obviously is be a great cost to Sony, particularly a remake of the movie Annie, in which they've invested quite a lot of money. And at this point, along with denying any involvement, the North Korean authorities have almost implied that they are involved by saying, quoting, "The hostile forces are relating everything to the DPRK. I kindly advise you to just wait and see." So,
yes.
What do you think's coming down the pike? What more can they do?
Well, maybe they will, you know, continue with their cyber attacks. I think they're particularly protesting to this movie, The Interview, starring Seth Rogen and James Franco, because when the preview came out earlier this year, North Koreans said that there was active war. You know about the movie, The Interview, right?
Sure, yes. I'm here in Hollywood. It's inescapable.
Right. So North Koreans already reacted to that by saying that it's an act of war, that so they've already warned us, and now they're not denying it. And cyber attacks are something that North Koreans have been increasingly resorting to. If you remember, I think it was in 2013, earlier in 2013 and in 2012 too, there were some major cyber attacks against South Korea, serious breach of the bank system, the financial market, major cyber effects that were identified as North Korean. There were targeting prominent South Korean banks and broadcasters and online networks. This was last year. So in response, the South Korean government has already been really beefing up their cybersecurity in response. So this has been a sort of a new form of threat coming out of North Korea that's been ongoing for some time. So I'm not surprised at all that they are reacting to this movie and that they are resorting to cyber attacks.
And there have been reports that Chinese cyber warriors, which are associated with the Chinese People's Liberation Army, may be involved in this. Do you have any information along those lines?
I don't have any confirmation of that, but I can it's very likely that North Korean agents are operating also out of China. That has been done before, working with Chinese. So that wouldn't be a surprise to me either, but I have no confirmation of that.
Well, apparently some of the postings from this group calling themselves GOP, which is not the Grand Old Party, they even go talk directly to the CEO of Sony, Michael Linton,
right,
saying...
They call themselves Guardians of Peace, is that right?
Yeah, Guardians of Peace, like right, GOP.
Right.
But they say to, you know, you, the criminal, including Michael Linton, will surely go to hell. Nobody can help you.
Yes, but they are all about bluster. You know that, Ian. And that is all about bluster and all about threats. And this is a new form of threat. The North Koreans have been increasingly unhappy recently because their various charm offenses have not been working. Not are they only upset about this, against the Sony and the new movie that's coming out, but you know, the recent attention on human rights, recent United Nations General Assembly resolution saying, you know, North Korea's human rights violations are, crimes against humanity, and they refer to UNSC to look into it, to possibly refer North Korea to international, court of ICC for crimes against humanity. So they have been increasingly frustrated for the last couple of months, they've resorted to a charm offensive for a while to get this attention on human rights away from them. And so now that have not worked. This movie is coming out. So they're just lashing out in every direction. And now that the charm offensive with the human rights thing have not been working, they've also threatened to conduct a new nuclear test too. So I'm sort of afraid that their charm offensive phase might be kind of over, and you know they will continue it with different form of provocation. This is one form of provocation, certainly.
Again, I'm speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University, and previously she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. So if then, I mean, I think to my mind, though, this sort of gets to the nature of the regime, doesn't it? In the extent, yes, to which the leader is deified as a god and a part of a pantheon of gods,
right,
the Kim family. And I don't know whether he personally, Kim Jong-un, is reacting in a fit of pique or whether the sycophants around him are. But it seems to me that what's at stake for them is the very glue that holds this delusion of this regime together, isn't it? That this movie, yes, attacks, and you know, we know
absolutely that. Absolutely right. And Kim Jong-un is definitely the one who is bothered, not only the sycophants. I think he has very thin skin. He's extremely bothered by this. And again, even the human rights violations, the UN thing, it's because they named Kim Jong-un himself as somebody who's responsible personally against crimes against humanity. So again, with this movie, because he himself is now being attacked, I mean, you know, the storyline is about, I guess, a couple of journalists who goes into North Korea to assassinate Kim Jong-un. He's extremely bothered by that. But now I don't think it's just because of his, you know, he has a thin skin. I think there's just so much uncertainty that's going on inside North Korea that we don't know of. You know, there has been a lot of reshuffling at the top elite level. There has been a lot of, you know, movement internally. And maybe the situation is just not as stable as how it might appear. And this kind of attack on Kim Jong-un, even though it's completely silly to us, it's a movie, it is maybe very concerning to Kim Jong-un and his people.
Well,
and by the way, you know, information has been going into North Korea, outside information. So imagine a movie, this particular movie, going into North Korea through the China-North Korea border, and more North Koreans actually seeing their leader being made fun of this way, or even, you know, I'm sure Kim Jong-un himself is extremely bothered by this.
Well, in executing his uncle, the second most powerful person in the land, it seemed to me,
right,
that the young Kim was sending a message to everybody in the country that nobody is safe. If the second most powerful man in the world is not safe, none of,
right,
you are. And that may signal a kind of need for him to feel, perhaps he does feel insecure and needs to consolidate his power in that ruthless way. Is that how you interpret it?
No, absolutely. When he executed Chang Sung-taek, his uncle, in December 2013, not only that, he has been constantly reshuffling the top leadership. We have like the sixth new general that's running the Korean People's Army. So, you know, I think he's definitely sending a message that he, you know, he's not to be messed with, he's in control, and so on. But unfortunately, the way I see it is, the very fact that he needs to do that, and he needs to constantly reshuffle the elites and kill Chang Sung-taek and everybody that's associated with him, shows me that there are more, you know, the situation is inherently more unstable in North Korea rather than stable.
So they apparently have real genuine fears over the UN indicting Kim Jong-un before the International Criminal Court.
Yes.
And I spoke recently with Ambassador Donald Gregg, who was instrumental in working with the top North Korean official here at the United Nations,
yes,
in getting the release of the Americans held captive. So that's the charm offensive you're talking about?
Yes. Ambassador Gregg and I hold a very different view. Ambassador Gregg actually even brought a North Korean ambassador to the United Nations, to the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a think tank in New York, where that North Korean ambassador was defending North Korea's human rights record, saying that how much the situation under Kim Jong-un, human rights situation, have improved in North Korea. And the way he was defending it was by saying, you know, look how much things have Kim Jong-un has done for us. He has built an amusement park, a ski resort. I mean, he actually listed these things as an evidence of human rights record improving. Now, so I am definitely talking about that. The North Koreans were involved in a big charm offensive for months. They came to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York think tank defending their human rights record. They were, you know, going around everywhere so people could listen. And I think releasing the two Americans had to do with that. They wanted to show the world that, hey, we're not so bad, because this was right before the United Nations General Assembly vote on the human rights resolution.
So, but
that has passed. I think the North Koreans are extremely upset by that, and they came out and then said that they were very upset by that. And now they were, you know, have to resort to conducting more provocations, including another nuclear test.
So, but what Ambassador Gregg said it was, in terms of his motivations for doing this diplomacy that he's been engaged in, and of course he's, you know, he's certainly no longer in government, the way he put it was, I'd rather talk than fight. So are those the choices here? I mean, is it that stark?
I don't know if it's that stark. We're not fighting right now. We're not talking, right? So there is another option of what the Obama government is pursuing right now, which is neither. We're not fighting nor, talking. I'm not personally against the talks. If we have to talk to North Koreans, that's fine. Talk to them. But that should be tactical. We talk to them to slow down their nuclear program. But let's not be under any illusion that they are going to change their ways. What evidence have they shown that they are willing to change their ways? What has Kim Jong-un done since coming into power, besides executing his uncle and building an amusement park and, you know, a ski resort and so on? So I just don't think, 20 years of diplomacy, we tried talking to North Koreans, bilateral format, in a six-party format. We tried giving them aid. We tried talking to them. So that has clearly failed. It has not worked. I don't think anyone would deny that our policy of, purely focused on just nuclear issue and talking to North Koreans have not worked for 20 years. And by the way, so I think this renewed attention on North Korea's human rights thing is a very good thing. And we have not done that. We have always sort of not prioritized human rights. We have sort of always kicked that can down the road because we were always, we were overly focused on just the nuclear issue. But the North Koreans are clearly bothered by the human rights thing, which I didn't think they would be initially. I thought, why would they care? Just, they should. But they do. They absolutely do care. And it's clear because how North Korea's been reacting. So in a way, besides being the right thing to do, human rights also is sort of a leverage. It's sort of a leverage against North Korea that we didn't have before. The last time I've seen this kind of leverage was when we had Benko Delta Asia sanctions in 2005. So I'm all for, sort of this renewed attention on human rights. I think just focusing on the nuclear issue has not worked for us.
But you've suggested that it's almost, at least that's just how I'm interpreting what you said, that it's almost inevitable that North Korea will go ahead with another nuclear test. And that, of course, alarms.
Of course. And nothing would have stopped that. They're very, they've engaged in this. This is their utmost priority. They have to. Just because they were engaged in a charm offensive, they slowed down. They, pivot back to sort of this peace offensive stage. We should not be under delusion that there was going to be, that North Korea was in any whatsoever way willing to give up nuclear weapons. That was just never in the cards.
Well, it's so strange, isn't it, that movies are playing a big part in geopolitics with this new Seth Rogen, James Franco movie.
What North Koreans don't realize is that they are really marketing the movie for them. Otherwise, this would have been a silly movie that no one, might have watched. But now they're promoting this movie. I'm certainly going to go see it now.
Well, there's also another movie, by the way, that Angelina Jolie directed called Unbroken, which is a true story. And apparently they're having trouble getting a release in Japan because Japan is getting, you know, as you know, quite nationalistic and revisionist
under the Abe administration. Yes.
Yeah, about the history of World War II. Right, and they don't want to believe some of the of what happened during the war in terms of the atrocities committed by the Japanese army. So, but it seems to me, though, that the North Koreans attacking Sony, isn't that a win-win? They attack the Americans and the Japanese at the same time.
Yes, it's a double whammy from a North Korean perspective.
Right.
By the way, South Korea has banned this movie, apparently, the interview, because they're worried about how North Koreans were going to act. So North Koreans took this, you know, take this movie very seriously, as silly as that sounds.
And they managed to, the South Koreans have just unilaterally decided to ban it, not to aggravate?
Yes, not to air it, because they just didn't, you know, they don't want to deal with whatever excuse that's going to give North Koreans for yet another provocation. They just rather ban the movie. So they have banned it.
Sure. But now, since the North Koreans have more or less implied, saying wait and see, you know, that sort of threat that they've made, what more can they do? I mean, releasing a movie, it's extremely vulnerable. I mean, think about it. All those people going into movie theaters, you know, if a bomb goes off, how far can this go, do you think?
No, I really doubt the North Korea is going to resort to that kind of terror attack. I think what they're talking about is a nuclear test, missile test, the cyber test. I've always told you North Koreans are different sort. They're different sort from like the terrorist groups. They are not ideological. They're not suicidal. Their utmost priority always has been regime survival. They know if they conduct if that's, you know, the kind of, that will lead to a serious retaliation, which would then lead to a real conflict, and that's not what they want. So I doubt, you know, they're going to resort to that.
Well, so far they've been incredibly clever, haven't they? I mean, hacking into to Sony's website, which astounds me that Sony had such poor cyber protection. But, you know, the idea that they handed over Sony's unreleased movies to pirate sites and costing the company a lot of money,
I do believe they will continually think of new and creative ways to conduct provocation, but not to the point where it's obviously to North Korea, you know, it's North Korea, like, a big attack in the U.S. That could lead to the North Koreans, and then they will lead to a serious escalation. I don't think they will do that. I think they'll be more clever than that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Sumi Terry. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Again, I've been speaking with Sumi Terry, who's a senior research scholar at the Weatherhead East Asia Institute at Columbia University. Previously, she was a National Intelligence Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the former Deputy National Intelligence Officer for East Asia at the National Intelligence Council, and the Director of Japan, Korea, and Oceanic Affairs at the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Mike Farrell about the pending execution of a mentally ill man in Texas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Farrell, a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a non-profit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Farrell.
Thank you very much, Ian. Nice to be with you.
Likewise, Mike, and unfortunately, on Wednesday night at 6 p.m. local time in Texas, a manifestly paranoid schizophrenic man, Scott Panetti, is going to be put to death. Is there any hope, you think, of an intervention on Governor Perry that will resonate and enable the governor to stop what even many conservatives in this country consider an atrocity?
Well, I suppose one can never give up hope. Governor Perry has not given us ever a sense that he is sensitive to the humanity of this, or inhumanity, I should say, of this process, and therefore the particular inhumanity of the execution of a man that, as many have said, crosses a moral line. I personally think that there's still a possibility at the U.S. Supreme Court, but that's my view. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's legally tenable. The opportunity, though, that we have to recognize here is the one that was recognized by one of the judges on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals that recently refused the plea to allow for a new test of his competence. He himself is a longtime Republican judge on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. He's announced not only did he dissent in the appeal, but he announced that it is a great example of the fact that the death penalty should be abolished. We're killing innocent people. We're killing deranged people. We're killing people that don't belong in that. On that level of incarceration, it's an insane, forgive the use of the term in this instance, but it's really an insane system that we're operating. And this, I think, is the Panetti case is a prime example of its insanity.
Well, the Supreme Court has previously been involved with this case. They upheld a 2004 federal judge's stay of execution of Panetti on the grounds that the lower court standards of determining a defendant's mental competency was unconstitutional. But the Texas authorities didn't give up, and they sent the case back down to the same lower court, the Fifth Circuit, to correct what they called errors in the prosecution. And in 2013, a psychiatrist testified that he thought that Panetti was competent enough to understand why he was being executed. So is that the standard? In other words, it's okay to kill somebody as long as they understand why you're killing them?
Well, unfortunately, in some instances it is. Here in California, we have a case of a man who was deemed competent to be executed because one of the psychiatrists said he was able to complete a game of tic-tac-toe. Panetti believes, according to his attorneys, Panetti believes that he is being executed by a satanic commitment to end his life because he has been preaching Christianity to his fellow inmates. Does that, Rick, suggest competence to anybody? But, unfortunately, you can find these so-called experts who will say, well, he knows the difference between right and wrong. He knows that it's not a good idea if I punch him in the nose. And therefore, he knows the difference between right and wrong, and therefore, he's competent to be executed.
It's worth noting that these experts take hefty fees, right?
Oh, they do indeed. And the prosecution around the country finds the ones that are sympathetic to them and continues to go to them rather than going to an objective analyst in so many of these instances. Now, I don't want to call into question the ethics or the credentials of the person who made that determination, because he may have or she may have had a meeting with Panetti and found him to be not the alter ego that he manifests so much of the time. But anybody who is in that business should know that there is a great deal wrong with a man who, as I think the public now knows from all the coverage that's been done in the various aspects of the press, wore a cowboy suit to his trial, was allowed by a judge who makes no sense to me to defend himself, tried to subpoena John F. Kennedy, who was dead at the time, Jesus Christ, and a number of other luminary figures to testify on his behalf, had a lateral conversation between himself and his alter ego on the stand. I mean, this is there's something one can say, and I'm sure some do. Well, he's faking. But this is a guy who has been hospitalized dozens of times prior to the fact that to the time of this crime for his psychiatric delusions and for his obvious illness. And he has manifested this time and time again since that time, and consistently since that time. What is criminal in this instance, in my view, is the judge, the initial judge, who allowed him to not only have the trial go forward, but allowed him to defend himself instead of having a competent attorney represent him and do what any competent attorney would have done, which is to say this man is not competent to be tried.
Again, I'm speaking with Mike Farrell, who's a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. Now, I think that you've made, a key point here, Mike Farrell, and that is what was going on in the mind of that judge who permitted this manifestly schizophrenic man to act as his own lawyer, and apparently it was quite a display. There's something kind of macabre about the idea that perhaps people in the judiciary, including the judge, were enjoying the bizarre theatrics of this defendant dutied up in his cowboy clothes, ranting about Satan. And of course, ranting about Satan is a common manifestation of the psychotically insane. Is that a possibility that this is just really a kind of almost goes back to the days of the Roman Colosseum? It seems barbaric to me.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And the Texas system, of course, is renowned, if that's the proper word, for its death system and its use of it and its enjoyment of it. As we know, Governor Perry, when he was campaigning for the presidency, talked about having I got a great round of applause, as a matter of fact, from an audience when he talked about having no second thoughts and having lost no rest for being the governor in the history of the United States who's executed more people than anyone else. But it's throughout that system, and I'm frankly disturbed by the idea that, you know, we're Texas, we do it our own way, don't bother us, this is the Texas way. It permeates the system. When the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals can refuse this man a competency test when he hasn't been tested for 7 years, when the prosecutor can refuse or not refuse, can carefully make sure that the defense attorneys are not given notice of the man's impending execution. Until a time when it's almost impossible for them to do the necessary work to respond to this notice, then you begin to think that there's an intention in this system that is quite bizarre and I think criminal.
So what's your understanding then, Mike Farrell, of what Governor Perry has done or said in response to this letter from 21 conservative leaders, including the Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli, conservative activist Brent Bozell, former presidential candidate Gary Bauer, and Ron Paul, former presidential candidate and libertarian father of Rand Paul? These are fairly prominent conservatives. They've all weighed in. Have you heard anything back in response from Governor Perry?
I have heard nothing. The governor in Texas has the right to delay an execution for 30 days. I don't know that he has the right to simply stop it. He would have to go to his Board of Pardons and Paroles to get their approval of his commutation to life without parole, for example. But the process in Texas seems to me to be one that is politically viewed as beneficial to one's political ambitions to be as ruthless and as murdering and as unforgiving and as merciless as possible.
Well, the letter that the 21 Conservatives wrote is actually a very reasoned letter, and it's hard to believe that somebody would not want to respond to it. You know, the first paragraph, Dear Governor Perry, we respectfully ask you to commute Scott Panetti's death sentence to life in prison if the Board of Pardons and Paroles recommends it. Mr. Panetti is one of the most seriously mentally ill prisoners on death row in the United States. Rather than serving as a measured response to murder, the execution of Mr. Panetti would only serve to undermine the public's faith in a fair and moral justice system. You know, this is...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, just say, you know, this, I could read more. I mean, it's a stronger letter. It's a very, very reasoned and strong letter. And the credentials of those signing it are, you know, the who's who of the conservative movement.
No, I quite understand. And, you know, traditionally you have the Pope standing up for people and the American Psychiatric Association and the Mental Health Association of America and Disability Rights Texas and the kinds of groups that have come forward in opposition to this execution. In many instances have come forward before, but I think you're quite right. This one, when you have 50 evangelical faith leaders, Sam Rodriguez of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, Jay Sekulow of the American Center for Law and Justice, people that are not traditionally on record against the death penalty, making this kind of request, it seems to me that it deserves a respectful response at a minimum, but in my view, more than that, and that is a serious reconsideration and action on the part of the governor.
So what do we know then about Scott Panetti's? We know that he shot his in-laws in 1992, apparently in front of his wife and child. But we don't know, do we, how he got the weapons? Because he'd been previously diagnosed as a schizophrenic. He's been diagnosed 14 times, after all.
That's quite correct. And whether or not, you know, I have no knowledge of how he got the weapons, but I'm not surprised that someone in Texas could get weapons. Texas has an open carry statute now. I'm not sure what the situation was at that point.
Well, we know that Governor Perry is running for president, and he's already, in effect, made life miserable for millions of his fellow Texans, particularly poor people, in terms of rejecting free money from the federal government for Medicaid expansion, which
right.
seems just that, you know, talk about cruel and unusual punishment. There's absolutely no skin off his nose, and yet he's doing that only for his own personal political ambition, it would seem. And my fear in this case, Mike Farrell, is that this is exactly what's going on as well in this case. The reason he's being so hard-nosed is that he wants to burnish his law and order credentials ahead of his presidential race. And frankly, I recall that Bill Clinton did something similar, did he not, when he was running for president?
Yes, he did. In 1992, I believe it was, he came down from the campaign in New Hampshire to preside as governor over the execution of Ricky Ray Rector, who had been sentenced to death for the murder of a police officer, and at the time he was arrested, shot himself in the head and was never the same after that. Rector is the one who's famous or infamous, if you will, for having lived on death row as a man totally incompetent, and when he was carried or sent to the death chamber, given his last meal and left the dessert. And the warden or the guard said, you haven't eaten your dessert. He said, no, I want to save that till I come back, an indication of the fact that he had no conscious awareness of where he was going and what was going to happen. So, yes, you're quite right. The politicians across the board have been ruthless in their pursuit of political credentials that serve them as being tough on crime. And this has been happening since, in my view, since the late 60s when the Nixon-Agnew approach decided that demonizing communism was no longer of value to them, and they had to find something else to demonize. So they decided to demonize criminals, and the way in which you show how tough you are on crime, rather than being labeled as soft on crime, was to be tough on crime. And the way you demonstrated how tough you are on crime was to be willing to kill people. And that has been that has carried us to the place where we are today. And it is beginning, it seems to me, to deteriorate. People in the body politic are beginning to understand that tough on crime, it doesn't make as much sense as does smart on crime, and that we need to take another look at the policies that have put us in the situation where we now incarcerate more people in our prisons in this country than any other country in the world at a rate of 2.3 million people. And we have the largest death row, one of the largest death rows in the United, the largest death row in the United States is here in California, I'm ashamed to admit. And we are one of the top five executing countries in the world.
Well, just in closing, Mike Farrell, given that it's unlikely that Governor Perry will do the right thing here, in spite of the urging of a number of prominent conservatives, you mentioned earlier that the Supreme Court could intervene. It seems in many ways that the Supreme Court is just as culpable in a sense. I mean, how have they let this get this far, and why are they not stopping this cold?
I couldn't agree more, Ian. I think the Supreme Court, I think there are those on the Supreme Court who would want to stop this, and that's why I said at the outset, I'm hoping that there still is the possibility of Supreme Court action. But we have a number of people sitting on the Supreme Court today who continue to insist that the death penalty is appropriate, and not only that, but continue to insist that we have never executed an innocent person in the face of the mountains of evidence that that is simply not the case. So we have, again, we have this ideological fixation on the parts of some people that is apparently set in concrete and is not willing to be altered by contrary facts. This is something that I think only the people in this country can ultimately change, and that is done by the basis of who they put in office and what responsibility they take for the people's actions once they are in office.
Well, Mike Farrell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. I'm sorry to say that it's not a pleasure to talk about this subject, but it's a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mike. And again, I've been speaking with Mike Farrell, who's a political and social activist best known for his portrayal of B.J. Honeycutt in the TV series MASH and Jim Hansen in the NBC series Providence. He is the president of Death Penalty Focus, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the abolition of capital punishment through grassroots organizing, research, and the dissemination of information about the death penalty and its alternatives. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.